things we're going to look at today is going back to a story a lot of people a few years ago were looking at, but we're going to take it at a little different time frame than usual. Now, the question always been, in Anbar province, in the areas around Fallujah and Ramadi, the Marine Corps and local tribal areas helped turn the corner. And who were the people involved in that, both on the U.S. and the Iraqi side? What were some of the catalysts that brought about that change at both the, really at the tactical level, but there are also operational and strategic lessons that we can learn from this? And our guest for the full hour to discuss is a gentleman who has written a book on this time period, Bill Ardolino, and his new book is Fallujah Awakened, Marines, Sheiks, and the Battle Against Al-Qaeda. Bill is also an associate editor at the Long War Journal. He was embedded with the U.S. Marine Corps, the Army, the Iraqi Army, and the Iraqi police in Fallujah, Habananya, who I cannot pronounce today, and also Baghdad in 2006, 2007, and 2008. The latter, he was with U.S. and Afghan forces in Kabul, Helmand, coast provinces in Afghanistan. Bill, welcome back to the U.S. and welcome back to MidRaps.
Thank you for having me.
Great. Yeah, you're reaching these little towns, you're used to reading, but when you have to actually speak them, it's a little bit different.
Habaniya,
thank you. I knew that, just couldn't get it out of my mouth. Habaniya, thank you very much. Say it four times and you'll have it for the rest of the time. In the intro, I briefly covered, when you say Fallujah, a lot of people think of what is traditionally called the first or the second battle of Fallujah. In your book, though, you cover a different time frame. What time frame is it you cover, and what was different about the time frame for your book versus what other people think of as the first and the second battle of Fallujah?
Right. So, like you mentioned, a lot of people have covered the 2004 battles in Fallujah, most notably Bing West covered it with his book No True Glory. And a bunch of other authors have covered the invasion of the city that actually took place when Marines and U.S. soldiers and Iraqi soldiers went in and kicked out the insurgents. What I cover in my book is actually a couple of years later, which is a reinvigorated insurgency in and around the city, and actually throughout Anbar province, of course. And what I cover is the tribal awakening and the Marine counterinsurgency campaign that wound up finally sort of pacifying this area at the tail end of the Iraq War.
When you have different characters in the book, obviously, or categories of characters, the Marines involved here were a little different than an active duty or duty company. Could you kind of explain the background of the Marines involved at the time of your book?
Well, I cover specifically, I focus on a specific company of the 1st Battalion Alpha Company of the 1st Battalion 24th Marine Regiment, and with additional augments from the 3rd Battalion 24th Marines. And these are infantry reservists. So it's not an active duty unit, and it was a reserve unit. What was interesting about it was for the counterinsurgency fight that they took on, which involved sort of interaction with locals that could almost resemble police work or social work as much as it did, sort of infantry fighting. The reservists actually took to this type of battle with greater skill, I would almost argue, because they had this variety of civilian experience. Such as experience in law enforcement, experience as first responders, paramedics, and such, that they really kind of took to the counterinsurgency mission very well. So it was actually, I think, fortuitous in the end that a reserve unit was in the right place at the right time to sort of take on this fight.
Another one of the major group players in your book were the Iraqi tribe, the Abu Aysa. Who were they, and what was kind of their history in the area around Fallujah?
Well, so the Abu Aysa are basically, there are four major tribes around Fallujah, and arguably the Abu Aysa are the largest or most significant tribe. And they basically govern what's called the Fallujah Peninsula, which is a suburban and rural extension of the city of Fallujah that is a peninsula. And the Albaiza are a very ancient tribe. They've been around quite a long time. Their history with the Americans in Fallujah has sort of a dual character, because some of the Albaiza sheikhs early on in the war sort of saw the Americans as, you know, partners that they could probably bargain with, and saw them as people who hopefully might rebuild Iraq into a like we did Germany and Japan after World War II, for example. And then other members of the Albaiza, including a lot of religious clerics and firebrands, saw the Americans as infidel occupiers that needed to go. So very early on, you sort of had this split within the tribe itself, where a lot of people joined the insurgency and they welcomed foreign jihadists to fight the Americans. And then other people, typically businessmen, saw the Americans as just another foreign power to deal with. And that basically, at the same time, there was an insurgency that kicked off against the Americans, sowed the seeds of a civil war within the tribe for who was going to take over the tribe.
You know, we need to discuss how all these parties come together, especially the foreign insurgents. But one of the first thoughts I had when I was reading the book was it reminded me of the old movie Red Dawn. You know, to the extent that the certain levels of the Iraqis thought that they were fighting a foreign invader and who had usurped the power. I mean, did that kind of thinking ever enter your mind, or as a background for why they were so resistant to American help?
Oh, absolutely. Fallujah itself is a very historically independent area, let's put it that way. You know, from the Ottomans to the British to, you know, obviously the American involvement in Iraq, they are very independent and they fight. And so it would sort of be analogous to, you know, if another country showed up in Texas and ran into some, you know, people who said, hey, you know, we're going to kick your ass out of this country. So the other aspect of this is, you know, and this a lot of speaking to a lot of Iraqis when I was over there, you know, I spoke to a number of Iraqis who, after things had sort of calmed down and they had started to work with the Americans, said to me, hey, you know, when I first met you guys, I thought you were here trying to steal Iraq's oil. I thought you were trying to take over Iraq. You know, I thought you wanted to stay. And when now that we realize that you want to leave and you're sort of helping us on your way out, I realize you guys aren't so bad. And so it really was, you know, a case of, you know, miscommunication, but also sort of the natural independence of Fallujah citizenry, which when Americans first came into the country, caused them to resist America quite energetically.
I like your observation about, you know, invading Texas vice invading, oh, I don't know, let me see if I can fight with somebody, invading Vermont. You know, you might get a different reaction from your average villager, so to speak. Vermont's a small state.
You should have chosen New Jersey, so.
I don't know. Well, that actually is a good fold in there, Eagle One, because one of the challenges that everybody has, and as somebody whose specialty is taking a situation happening far away and trying to explain that to the American public. One of the big challenges we have had is trying to explain something we've lost. I have a little bit of flavor of it because I come from an old line Mississippi family, which, you know, you go back a couple of hundred years, you are related to everybody. We still hold grudges from when Grant burned the town, the whole nine yards. But Americans are very detached from the concept of tribe. I remember the first time they mentioned to me, pre-9/11 in Oman, somebody just mentioned it as an Obi way. About, well, it's not so much the Omani, but what tribe they're from. It just kind of seems strange to me. But it's very critical part of many cultures that we're going to find ourselves having to interact with even more in time. But how do you explain, in a modern context, the tribal structure? A lot of societies, even some you might even consider modern, still plays in a culture, and how Americans not understanding that, how that affects how we look at interactions, and how we might be able to be our best or our worst enemy simply by not understanding that cultural context. So if you had to kind of briefly outline it, how these tribes work in a context Americans can understand, how do you best do that? Because it is really a foreign concept in many ways.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm still scratching my head trying to figure out how to explain it simply. The tribes in Iraq, you know, they operate sort of outside of government authority, and they have, you know, even when Saddam Hussein kept his grip on Iraq, he sort of let them do their own thing while also trying to keep them divided so they wouldn't take him out. So it was sort of it's never a 100% fusion with what we consider modern government. So, you know, the best way to look at them are as extended family units, which is exactly what they are, who have extreme loyalty to their tribe over their country, over their security forces, over anything else. This varies between rural and urban populations. So, obviously, the more rural you go, farther outside of cities, the tribes gain strength and gain authority, whereas, you know, a 20-year-old who's living in the middle of Baghdad may have very little connection to the tribal lineage that he's from. And even some people who lived within the city of Fallujah itself had lost some of that allegiance that they had to their tribe. But, you know, essentially you have to look at them as extended family units. And in Iraq, you know, they alternately compete with each other or work together if they see, you know, business benefit, or in the case of fighting Americans, getting rid of somebody they think is, you know, trying to steal Iraq's natural resources. They can, you know, form accords and form alliances. And I think what you saw with the Awakening was an example of where the tribal structure in Iraq really came together as one to fight, you know, Salafist jihadist insurgent groups that had started killing them off and turning greedy and, you know, infringing upon their revenue streams and really just making life miserable for everybody. In other cases, these tribes united to fight the Americans earlier in the war. So, and in other cases, they fight each other. Although in Iraq, which is a sort of a more, I would say, modern tribal society than some place like Afghanistan, there are more conflict resolution procedures in place to where there isn't usually this all-out war between tribes like you may see in Afghanistan. And the other thing that Americans need to understand about the tribes is that they operate with a very clear set of rules. You know, they have their own criminal and civil codes to solve issues and, you know, things like accidental or purposeful killings, you know, thievery, land disputes, any of this other stuff, and actually even personal interactions. And so whenever Americans go into a country, I don't see us fighting another counterinsurgency anytime soon, but whenever we go into a country that has this type of tribal structure, it's really incumbent upon commanders on the ground to learn about how these people operate, what their rules are. And if you play by their rules and you respect their rules, you can get a lot farther in establishing relationships with them, working relationships with them, than if you violate their rules and anger them.
Well, into the soup of U.S. Troops being involved, Marines in this case, the tribes, there's also, as you write in the book, a vast number of various Islamicist groups of varying degrees of radicalism that were bouncing around in there. So can you kind of discuss how the why they were first adopted and then rejected by the Iraqis?
Sure. So there are several phases to the insurgency, and the Sunni insurgency we're going to talk about. And the first phase would be the Ba'athists, the ex-members of Saddam Hussein's regime. I would say that they sort of fell out of the driver's seat after he was captured. And then you have this second wave of insurgents who came to the fore, who were, I would say, local religious firebrands. So you had some, you understand, Fallujah. The other thing about it that's interesting is it's one of the most conservative Sunni Muslim cities in Iraq. So it's called the City of Mosques because it's got, I don't know what the total number is now, but like 105 mosques. And Saddam Hussein, actually, after the first Gulf War, initiated something called his faith campaign, which he was sort of in a weakened position. He was afraid of his rebellious Shia population, which actually did revolt, if you recall, after the first Gulf War. And he was also afraid of Iran. And so what he did in a bid to try to consolidate Sunni identity in Iraq was he engaged on a faith campaign where he printed a bunch of copies of the Quran and distributed them, built a bunch of mosques. He started to include Sharia into penal codes, Iraqi penal codes, put Islamic script on the Iraqi flag. And he did all of this in a bid to sort of solidify, you know, Sunni religious identity and keep everybody united against his enemies. Well, what this actually had the practical impact of doing was it made a lot of people in Iraq, especially in the Iraqi military and in Anbar province, more religious. So when you actually had the U.S. Invasion come into Iraq again, you know, this was sort of dry tinder for very conservative clerics to sit there and say, we've got to throw out an infidel invader who is invading our country. So while there was a foreign jihadist element at that time, and foreigners did start pouring into Iraq around that time, there was a homegrown religious aspect to the insurgency. What wound up happening was, after the first and second battles of Fallujah, when both local Islamists and foreign jihadists like al-Qaeda and Zarqawi and Omar Hadid and all these guys were defeated and essentially kicked out of Fallujah, you started to see after that the rise of foreign Islamists, Salafist jihadist groups, I should say. And these are, you know, this is al-Qaeda. This is al-Qaeda's game. When they basically came to the fore in the insurgency and basically started killing everybody who disagreed with them. So they tried to consolidate all of these insurgent groups under a single banner called the Islamic State of Iraq, which was sort of their shadow government. And if you resisted them and you said, no, we're not going to follow your orders, you're not locals, you're not whatever, they would kill you. They would assassinate you. They would kill your family. They started stealing, you know, revenue streams from the tribes, encroaching on business opportunities, abusing people. And this is sort of the turning point where, you know, not just the tribes, but other insurgent groups started fighting with al-Qaeda. Some of these, and to add to the confusion, some of these insurgent groups still didn't like the Americans and kind of fought the Americans on the side, but saw al-Qaeda as almost an existential threat because they were so greedy about trying to establish power over the Sunni insurgency. And the way this plays into the book I wrote is, the tribe that I write about, the members who stood up against the radical insurgents, they consider themselves good Muslims, but they were not particularly radical or even very, very conservative. And they really, the type of lifestyle that al-Qaeda tried to force on everybody was completely alien to what these guys see as a vision for Iraq. And so there was a huge religious aspect to this. They also tried to subvert tribal power, and the insurgents tried to co-opt some of the historically worse-off sub-tribes to fight the richer sub-tribes. And so you had this entire civil war going on that basically, you know, in the case of the awakening, the Americans inserted themselves into and helped pick the winners. Does that explain
it? Yeah, I think that's about a four-year doctoral dissertation in a couple of minutes. One of the things that comes up occasionally in the book, and people who read accounts of the Iraqi war, and it's also something that we have in Afghanistan, is your average soldier or Marine on the ground, a frustration of not getting help from locals who obviously know what's going on, but don't really have a fully fleshed out view of the position that your average Iraqi, the the guy who has a small shop, who's just trying to get by, a small landholder, just want to get from point A to point B, but they're stuck in, like you said, especially in this area, not just the Americans versus the insurgents, but the insurgents are wheels within wheels of competing entities. What is a fair way to view that average Iraqi villager, and what was the calculus in their mind between indifference to reaching the point that they were willing to pick a side?
Fear. I mean, the balance of fear. They. It's interesting because, not like I want to show too much sympathy for the insurgency here, but when it became widespread, it is sort of like a casual, we're the home team and we're going to fight these foreigners. Okay. So there was sort of a casual support of the insurgency because it's just almost in a way natural, to think, these are the people from my hometown and they're fighting a good fight. I think that a lot of Iraqis very quickly soured on that though. And they came to realize, in the power vacuum, that there were a bunch of criminals running around. I mean, for every person who said they were a freedom fighter or whatever, they were really running a criminal scheme and kidnapping people and stealing things and killing people and doing all kinds of things like that. And so the average Iraqi was sort of caught in the middle of all of this, to where they've got insurgent groups who are fighting each other. They've got people who are fighting the Americans. They've got the Americans who are, getting in firefights in the middle of their neighborhood. And I think that the reason, why Iraqis, a lot of them, even after they had soured on the insurgency, did not help the Americans or look the other way was because they were afraid. For example, if you got caught feeding information to Americans, they kill you. They kill your family. They torture you. They kill kids. There were no civilized boundaries as far as what someone like, your average 20-year-old thug, Al-Qaeda thug, would do to somebody if they were caught, giving intelligence or providing tips to Americans about where bombs were hidden or anything like that. So basically the local population didn't have a lot of incentive to help. And they really were taking a huge risk in doing so. And until they had tribal support, and they had support from the Iraqi police and support from the Iraqi army and support from the Americans themselves, where they had a reasonable chance of providing a tip and actually having it put somebody away for a good long time or capture an insurgent, and there was a chance that their entire family wouldn't be killed for providing this information, they weren't going to cooperate until that security situation turned just enough to where they had hope that that things would turn out for the better. So it's, counterinsurgency is kind of like a snowball effect, to where when you get some success and you actually establish the validity of local security forces and security gets a little bit better, then it gets a lot better because people start flocking to the winner and realizing, I can stand up and I can provide information. And there's a good possibility I may not be killed or tortured for doing that.
Yeah, as I was reading the book, first the thing is, it's an excellent book, and I recommend everybody buy it and read it. I think it's going to be a possible textbook on counterinsurgency down the road. I kept thinking, and it brought home to me the old Mao quote about how the people are the water in which the revolutionary swims, and as you just said, I mean, it took somebody with enough guts to say, okay, we're going to help you pick out the fish that are swimming in our water and solve some of our own issues fight this insurgency. Can you say something about Major Wisnat, is that his name, and CWO5 Russell, about how they were working together to try and work through the intelligence aspects of this problem?
Yeah, actually, Major Wisnat, he's now a lieutenant colonel, and I do not know if Mr. Russell is retired yet. He's actually a lieutenant in the Chicago Police Department. These guys were guys with an intelligence background who basically very quickly seized on the importance of intelligence in winning this fight. You know, there's a tendency in the military, especially the Marines, they want to go in, they want to kick some ass, they want to fight an enemy and win battles. In the case of a counterinsurgency like they were facing on Fallujah's Peninsula, that military proficiency is less important. It's still important, but it's less important than how much information you have on who the insurgents are and what their networks are doing and how you can defeat them. And so I think Major Wisnan and Roussel basically brought to the table a background that was sort of the right leadership at the right time, because they recognized that they needed to establish local allies and partner with some of these people in these tribes and exploit these divisions in the insurgency and these divisions in Iraqi society to get local insight into the insurgency. Because without that, you're basically fighting blind. And so, you know, you would think, you know, all military leaders would recognize the importance of this, but you might be surprised, because you know, a lot of people don't sort of have the mindset necessary to, or the intellectual and emotional flexibility to sit there and say, okay, I'm going to start working with some of these people. Some of these people may have even shot at me before or shot at other Americans before, but I understand the fact that I need to ally with these people in order to establish enough of an information base to really take a run at the insurgency and not do it with a blindfold on. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I also liked, we're talking about writing a book on counterinsurgency. The fact that when you're in situations like this, there aren't just good guys and bad guys. There are good guys,
right,
and there are good bad guys, and there are bad bad guys. And also, counterinsurgency, lots of words written about it. There's doctrine. Doctrine is great. But really, it's also important, if you have the doctrine, to also to have the right personalities in place in order to take that rough outline of doctrine and be able to make it fit and work.
Right.
And one of those personalities on the other end that was really important for the success was actually an Iraqi who, in a rather campy case of cloak and dagger, went by the name Dark. Who was Dark,
yeah,
and what type of catalyst was he?
Dark was his real name is Sheikh Ifan Sidun Ifan Alasawi, and he actually was just recently assassinated earlier this year. Actually, the book was just before the book was going to press, and it was kind of a sad loss because he was a man who from a Western perspective, he has, don't get me wrong, he has some flaws, and he's not a perfect angel, but he was sort of a heroic figure in the sense that he had the guts to stand up against Al-Qaeda when very few people would do it. And he was a lesser sheikh in the tribe. He was like the 15th son of the 16 sons of the patriarch of the tribe. And he basically was a very aggressive, very ambitious young sheikh who had the ability to speak English, which was another reason why he allied with the Americans. And he basically took this willingness of his to stand up and start to form a militia against Al-Qaeda and parlayed it into advancement for himself within the tribe and advancement for his tribe as well. So he very quickly becomes after the war and during the later part of the war, a much more notable sheikh because he was willing to stand up and fight, whereas a lot of other sheikhs were very hesitant to do so until they, saw which way the wind was blowing. And, he was just sort of the perfect partner at that time. You know, once again, like you said, it was the personality shaped events. And in this case, his personality was that of a very ambitious, brave, and charismatic guy who said, I'm going to stand up and this is my chance to make my name and be a hero, and it's my chance to advance my place within the tribe, and it's my chance to help his people. I mean, I do think the guy had a lot of loyalty to his tribe, and he saw what Al-Qaeda was doing to the Al-Bawisa, and he was willing to stand up and try to stop them. And so what he wound up becoming was, and this is, you know, also partially due to his good English speaking ability, was, you know, the most effective partner, the first partner, and the most effective partner with the Americans in establishing security. As there was some more success that was generated by the tribal militia, other sheikhs came into the fold, some earlier than others. But he was really, from what I can tell, he was the first guy who stood up and said, I'm going to be your partner, and I'm actually going to give you actionable intelligence and support against Al-Qaeda. He is, by the way, my favorite subject of the book. I think he's a fascinating guy, and I think you know, the risk that he ran is just something that is really hard to communicate. I hope the book communicates it, but the risk someone like that ran in standing up and saying, "Here's my name, I'm coming after you," with the number of people Al-Qaeda was killing and assassinating, was pretty steep. And by the way, that also ties into why he was he established that nickname for himself, Dark. Yeah, part of it was cloak and dagger theatrics. Another reason was both insurgents and people, I guess, who started fighting them wanted to use nicknames just to kind of sort of cloak their identity a little bit. So obviously for insurgents, to avoid capture or getting killed by U.S. forces who might know their real identities or ID cards. And in the case of Dark, I think he probably adopted the name to avoid having the name Sheikh Ifan out there as forming a militia in the early days.
This is kind of asking for 2020 hindsight, but that's part of what history is, I guess. Did we make a mistake in disbanding the Iraqi military? Do we add to our trouble as putting all those guys in the street?
Well, there's a couple of schools of thought on this. One is that the military, the Iraqi military, disbanded itself after the U.S. invasion, which it kind of did. It melted away. But, you know, Bremer essentially made it an official order that the security forces were dissolved. He said at the time that it was issued some sort of statement at the time saying that it was to obtain a fresh start. So all of that structure of the Iraqi military, the Iraqi police, the Iraqi army that were still maybe in place and waiting in their houses may have come back to work. I think by officially rescinding it, I think it probably did shoot U.S. efforts in the foot. And, you know, a lot of Iraqis told me personally that it was a huge mistake, and it was something that signaled, you know, the old guard is not going to have a place in the new Iraq. And, you know, that goes for, you know, when you have a Ba'athist regime in place that are all of the civil servants and most of the civil servants and have the know-how to run the government and are deeply involved in the security forces. And then you say, you know what, we're going to de-Ba'athify this country. And there were, you know, there were arguable good reasons to do that. But you're basically telling these people you don't have a job and you may not have a place in the new Iraq. And so the message that sent was you should pick up arms and fight. So I do think that it hurt our efforts. And, you know, I think that Iraq and Anbar and Fallujah in particular were probably always destined for some sort of violent resistance. So I don't think that anything the Americans could have done perfectly would have eliminated that completely. But I do think that was a move that probably hurt us. Yeah.
And for those that may have joined us halfway through the show, our guest is Bill Ardolino. He's the author of the book Fallujah Awakens, Marines, Sheikhs, and the Battle Against Al-Qaeda. Now, something else, if we can kind of tie the two together, is you've recently returned from an embed in Kandahar in the south of Afghanistan. So you had a chance as an embed, which I think gives you that ability to look at things from lots of different angles, as is your training and background. Looking at counterinsurgency, how it succeeded in Iraq, but how is it actually working in Afghanistan, and how much is useful to compare to Iraq and Afghanistan? And even though they're two tribal-based structures, what are the big challenges that we have in Afghanistan that we may not have faced in Iraq?
Well, you know, the book is, like you said, it is a sort of a treatise on counterinsurgency. And, you know, counterinsurgency has gone through a lot of ups and downs, controversy over the past few years, because it was viewed as a strategy that saved Iraq. And then they tried it in Afghanistan, and Afghanistan is obviously not working out that quickly as it did in Iraq. And, you know, part of that is because there were local dynamics that are the primary drivers for the security improvement in Iraq, along with counterinsurgency. But there are also a lot of other social, geographic, and, tribal factors that basically prevent counterinsurgency from really taking hold like it did in Iraq. I mean, taking hold in Afghanistan as it did in Iraq. For example, I was just in Kandahar, and there is actually a little tribal awakening that's going on in Kandahar right now. The New York Times has even wrote about it. Stars and Stripes wrote about it, and of course I did as well at the Long War Journal. And basically, a bunch of villages spanning a number of tribes in Panjway district of Kandahar have started to rise up against the Taliban, for much the same reasons that tribes in Anbar province, Iraq, rose up against Al-Qaeda. They're sick of them planting bombs all over the place throughout their fields. Their kids stumble on the bombs and get killed. The Taliban, you know, routinely beats people, sometimes hung a couple of irrigation canal workers who were just trying to clear irrigation canals so that the farmers could get water for their crops. And, you know, these type of abuses have stimulated this tribal awakening. Well, the difference between that and the awakening in Iraq is that this tribal awakening butts up against some much deeper, bloodier tribal infighting in Kandahar province and Panjway district than any of the tribal conflicts that were taking place in Iraq. So there are actually other tribes at the edge of this awakening who have allied with the Taliban because they are blood enemies with these other tribes who are awakening. So what I'm seeing in Afghanistan, or at least in Panjway district, is this tribal awakening is going to run up against a boundary where, let's say, as the U.S. withdraws in 2014, I don't think this awakening is going to keep spreading. I think it's going to turn into basically a very bloody tribal civil war between these two forces, because there's just such a more drastic history of violent conflict in Afghanistan between the tribes than there was in this area, this particular area of Iraq. So there are a lot of other factors that make counterinsurgency difficult in Afghanistan. For example, you don't have even a minimally respectable government partner. So, you know, even with the government in Iraq being run by Maliki, who many Sunnis regard as a Shia Iranian proxy, the government still sent rations to Anbar province. They still paid cops, usually on time. They still, you know, performed almost like basic functions. And there was still a sense of nationalism in Iraq, to where there was a sort of a willingness to engage the government, or at least want to be part of the government. In Afghanistan, it's so rural, and the government has so little tradition of authority, and the government under Karzai is so corrupt and provides so little services, that there really isn't an option to push a viable government solution to people's lives in Afghanistan. It just doesn't exist. There's some nationalism in the sense that they'll gravitate toward the Afghan security forces, but as far as government, basic government support, like building roads, providing health clinics, providing food aid or anything like that, it's just, there's almost nothing. And so that provides a challenge for counterinsurgency doctrine when you're trying to, that basically revolves around propping up a legitimate force to be a counterweight to the Taliban. You just don't have it. The other thing I would say is that in Afghanistan, you have a you have a staging area in Pakistan for the Taliban that is not going away. And so, you know, Iraq, there was some infiltration from Syria, and obviously Iran was running its own proxy war, primarily in southern Iraq and Baghdad. But Iran eventually sort of backed off, and so did Syria. Pakistan continues to send waves of suicide bombers and Taliban and, insurgents into Afghanistan. Some with the actual support of the Pakistani military. Other times the Pakistani military and the intelligence services just sort of look the other way. And so as long as you've got this reservoir across the border, the staging ground, it seems like you're destined for never-ending conflict in Afghanistan. And so I don't think any tribal awakening or any other grassroots movement is going to have sort of the support to win that battle. The best-case scenario I see for Afghanistan is more of a proxy war where the United States and perhaps even India wind up continuing to support Afghanistan and its security forces in their fight against Pakistani proxies and the Taliban.
Yeah, sometimes you can trace a lot of the problems we're having in Afghanistan back to the original sin of the Bonn Agreement in 2002 when we tried to centralize government in an area that had never had it before. Just curiously, before I throw it back over to Eagle One, did you have a chance to read Jim Gantt's One Tribe at a Time? And if so, what would your take on his work?
I have not read it.
Okay, Eagle One.
Yeah, I know that you've actually assigned the proceeds from this book, as I understand it, to a charity. Would you like to discuss that a little bit?
Yeah. All the author proceeds for the first edition are going to the Semper Fi Fund to benefit injured service members. And it's just something I wanted to do. I've seen a lot of Marines, when I've been overseas. A lot of good people have gotten killed and injured, and it just seemed like the right thing to do. So, great organization. In my research, I found that, it's when you research charities and you try to figure out where their money actually goes, a very high percentage of the Semper Fi funds, money actually goes to helping Marines, and it goes to actually helping them. And actually, they help other service members as well. It actually goes toward helping the wounded with very practical things. So, whereas some charities might buy people baseball tickets or something like this, Semper Fi Fund tends to spend things on, building ramps or for handicapped people, or if a family has a movement expense or needs to move family members from point A to point B to support someone who's been wounded, they really apply their funds to things that that get the job done. So very happy that the book is associated with this charity and very happy to help it out.
That's terrific. One of the other questions, as your book pointed out to me, was whether or not we ought to have embedded cultural anthropologists to go along with groups when we get in, if we ever decide to get into a situation like these in Iraq and Afghanistan. Is that something that, do they belong in the civil action groups, or do they actually belong at the commander's elbow to help him figure out who's who in the troubled area?
Well, they actually have something like that the Marines instituted in Afghanistan. I saw it in Afghanistan, in Helmand province. They were called human terrain teams. And they were groups of anthropologists and, one guy was a former Green Beret, one guy was a former UDT diver, who had just sort of like a analytical skill set to sort of look at the cultural aspects. They would do polling in villages. They would advise on the local dynamics, the local tribes, all this other stuff. And so, that sort of sophisticated cultural analysis actually made its way to Afghanistan and was pretty robust. And they basically just traveled through different areas, would go into an area, assess it, and then give briefings to the commanders. So I think, it's interesting. You see the evolution of war over the past, decade plus. And whereas, we went into Iraq and, not everybody really had a clue as far as this type of stuff went. You know, people adapted, and the Marines especially adapted really well. I mean, by the time I got to Helmand Province, when they were just firing on all cylinders with counterinsurgency, it was just amazing how the institutional culture had changed and how everything was really geared around aggressively applying that doctrine, from adopting, you know, tribal condolence payments to understanding Pashtun Wali and, you know, applying all of these lessons that were very hard to learn in Iraq. There was sort of an institutional energy about applying counterinsurgency doctrine. And by the way, counterinsurgency doctrine actually in Afghanistan did work in certain pockets of the country. The thing is, was it sustainable? And, you know, you had sort of this abortive surge of forces in Afghanistan where, you know, it's sort of like they surged and then they said, well, we're going to try and see if we can turn this thing around in a year or two. And most environments are not like Iraq in 2007. You're not going to get results that quickly with counterinsurgency, even when it's perfectly applied in most environments. So even if counterinsurgency had a chance at working in Afghanistan, it would have required a much greater commitment that the current administration and perhaps the American people aren't really willing to put forth to try to change things there.
One thing we've seen in the last decade plus that we've been involved in this, and I guess Petraeus and Mattis were kind of the point men for this 4 or 5 years ago, was the development or really redevelopment of counterinsurgency doctrine. But it was kind of a shame to see because we actually, our military, you know, you can draw a bead wherever you want to, but the Indian Wars, but in modern times, from the Philippine insurrection to the Caribbean and Central American conflicts between the two world wars, through Vietnam, especially what the Marines did in Vietnam, that we keep getting involved in counterinsurgency and then having a willful desire to forget everything. In the old conventional army, and we've had a couple of guests on here that want us as soon as possible to forswear any type of counterinsurgency discussions, work, investment, any type of continuity. We just need to forget it and let's go back to nice pieces that fit on a map where you can draw red lines and little arrows. Is there an opportunity this time to not do what we've done in the past, which is, you know, Iraq is behind us, Afghanistan, this is the last fighting season from here on out, it's just going to be focusing on retrograde back home, that we can inculcate, develop, and refine and maintain some of that counterinsurgency lessons that we relearn the hard way for in the future when we need that again, which we will, where is always the big question, that we're not going to have to start from chapter one again. They'll have some type of maintenance. Do you see that out there? Or are we condemned to repeat the past again?
Well, I think the first step is you need to buy Fallujah Awakens and memorize it from cover to cover. I mean,
always step one. Yes.
This is. I mean, this is part of the reason why I wrote the book was to get these lessons down, and you know, for future small unit leaders who say, hey, you know what? I'm faced with this tribal situation. I've got this confusing war where I've got to, you know, communicate to young Marines how to deal with, or young soldiers how to deal with, you know, a very confusing set of circumstances. And, you know, there's a, like you said, there's a, in addition to my book, there's a very rich body of literature out there that talks about how to deal with insurgencies. So I think your question speaks to whether or not the institutional culture is going to maintain its readiness for counterinsurgency. I would probably say no, because that's not how institutions work. We're always seem to, you know, the military always and other institutions always seem to prepare for a certain type of threat and then and over prepare for one and then you get surprised with another. But that said, there is this great body of literature out there. There is this great depth of experience out there. And I think, if the smarter leaders are smart enough to read up on this stuff, and apply the lessons to any future conflicts. You know, no conflict is going to be exactly like another was, but there are, especially as far as, you know, when you've got a small band of insurgents running around making life miserable for everyone and blending in with the local population, there are some very clear lessons of how you should approach this and what you need to do to win a fight like this. Even, like I said before, even perfectly applied, though, it's a difficult type of fight. It's, you know, it's not just a matter of taking ground or killing enough people. It's a matter of changing local perceptions of security forces and winning their cooperation. And even after you've done that, there are still people who can slip through the cracks. And, you know, just as is still going on in Iraq today, detonate bombs and, you know, kill lots of people. So these things don't, I think I wrote in the book, they don't die out in a climactic battle. They rage on in small brush fires for years and years and years. And the biggest problem from a modern perspective is, especially from, you know, the American public's perception, is we don't really have the patience to fight protracted conflicts like this. And, you know, hopefully our lack of patience with Iraq from both the electorate and the political leadership doesn't wind up coming back to bite us now that Syria is starting to melt down next door.
Yeah, you did write in the book about the how long it takes, and I hearken back to previous guerrilla-type conflicts in Malaysia, which took years for the Brits and the government they supported to get that calmed down. And I also hearken back to my experience in the Kosovo thing. When I got over there, a very brief experience, the Kosovo thing, had an Italian officer draw me a diagram of the parties involved. And what he did was he put 12 pictures all exactly the same and then labeled them with different groups, you know, Kosovar Albanians, Kosovar Serbs, Kosovar whatever. They all looked exactly the same, which, you know, is one of the issues. You've got to give people time to sort out who's who and what it all means. And I think your book really covers how well this particular group of Marines put that together. What do we look forward to from you in the Long War Journal, and what else you got on the plate that we should see from you here in the future?
Well, right now I'm concentrating on promoting the book, and we'll run some excerpts of the Long War Journal. I'm also, sort of still working on a summation of where I think Afghanistan is headed after the U.S. drawdown, especially in southern Afghanistan. And, you know, It's funny, as complex as Iraq is, and I think I cover a lot of ground in the book, I still have a much easier time wrapping my head around Iraq than I do Afghanistan. I think it's for whatever reason, it's just a messier, even more complex situation than Iraq was. And I don't see many easy answers or solutions there. I think that, you know, what's going to happen is, as U.S. troops retrograde, and we're covering this here at the Long War Journal, and this is my personal prediction, not an official site prediction or anything like that, but I think you're going to see just a new phase of the war as U.S. troops draw down. And unless some sort of Pakistan solution is enacted, or Pakistan stops looking the other way or supporting the insurgent groups and sending them across the border, I think you're going to have just a new civil war going on in Afghanistan. And for at least for American interests, it's in our interest to make sure that the current Afghan government and security structure does not fail.
I share your opinion of Afghanistan. I remember sitting around the table with my father back in 2007, early 2007, which most people remember, you do as well, that was the bold-faced item above the fold. And I told my father at that time, I'm not as worried about Iraq as I am Afghanistan. And I wasn't the only person thinking that, and I think we find ourselves in 2013. It'll be an interesting couple of years to watch it. And one thing that you bring to this, and we've touched on it a few times today, is you've done multiple embeds in multiple locations. And embed opportunities are shrinking a bit, and some of the places like Syria are a completely different kettle of fish. But what I'm interested in asking you as we wind things up here is, in the course of the last half decade plus that you've been doing embeds, how have you seen the approach of the military towards embeds has changed at the tactical and operational level? For instance, how has the opinion and the way that senior officers interact with embeds changed, or their view of them? And perhaps even more importantly, the soldiers and Marines down at the platoon and company level, how has that relationship changed over the years?
Well, I first of all, I've only been doing this for about 7 years, so not quite 10 plus. But what I've seen as far as the I wouldn't say that there's a huge evolutionary arc, with the exception of what's going on with retrograde, and I'll get to that in a second. I would say when you embed as a reporter, it's really interesting. You know, there are all these people who talk about schools of thought, you know, in the journalism community over whether embedded reporting is true reporting, because it's, you know, you're obviously going to have some sort of bond or sympathy with the people who are protecting you. I think that's a bogus assertion. I think that embedded and non-embedded reporting each have their own unique perspectives that you can only get by doing one or the other. So, for example, whereas you may get more unfiltered local access and unembedded reporting, you're not going to get the view of military operations that you obviously would if, when you're embedded. So that's one thing. Second thing is units, you know, the military has this overall policy, a very open policy of, you know, getting reporters out into the field and getting them to show them different areas of operation. But there's a lot of variability in how individual public affairs units sort of take this responsibility. So I've embedded with units who are very closed and protective of bad stories and try to shuffle you towards positive stories or areas that aren't particularly kinetic. You know, I had a Marine public affairs officer deny me entrance into Sangin because it was so bad back when, the British were still there. And, you know, and in other instances, I've had Marine public affairs officers who would pretty much put me wherever I wanted to go and give me as open a journalistic access as possible. So I think even within the military itself, there's a lot of variability by unit of how they approach giving journalists access. And as a journalist, as a reporter, it's kind of your duty to figure out how to navigate that to get the story you want to get. As far as the evolution of the embed process, the really only overarching arc I've seen, and this was on my last trip, was because of the retrograde, because we are pulling out of Afghanistan, it's a little bit harder to get into certain areas. And once you're there, it's harder to even get out on patrol or get out into the villages or get out into operations. This isn't just because somebody's trying to manage the message. It's a more practical consideration of the fact that U.S. troops are doing less of these patrols. And sometimes they will only patrol if they have Afghan partners, and the Afghans don't go out as much as maybe they should. So I really haven't seen much of an overarching evolution. I would just say everything is sort of conditions-based and based on how any individual unit sees their relationship with the media. I think overall it is in every unit's best interest to try to identify media representatives who will give them a fair shake, not a positive story, but identify reporters who are fair and honest reporters. And then once, you know, these people are embedded with them, give them as open and honest access as they can without violating operational security. And I think it kind of works out best for everyone and really gives the American people a good idea of what's going on.
Well, Bill, I'm afraid we're out of time, but I really want to thank you for taking some time this Sunday afternoon to be on our show. And I highly recommend your book to people who are interested in COIN and interested in what happened in Afghanistan. I mean, Iraq, I'm going to say Afghanistan. And I want to thank you very much for being with us, and hope we can have you on again as things go down the road.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much, Bill. And I want to thank everybody who either was with us live or joined us here on the archive. We'll have, I hope, a great Memorial Day weekend, and we'll see you on the other end for another edition of Midrats. Cheers.
Family, a posse to please, try Dickie's Barbecue Family Packs. Our picnic pack for four people, our six pack for six, and our XL Family Pack for eight. They include your choice of barbecue meats, new sides, buttery rolls, and barbecue sauce. Order your family packs online at Dickies.com, pick them up on the way home, and treat those troops to Dickie's Family Packs.
Dickie's, we speak barbecue.
Sarah figured out that by switching to Metro PCS, she gets two free smartphones.
Your barbecue ribs are the best.
Take the rest home with you, Sarah.
Just like she figured out that by visiting her in-laws, she doesn't have to cook for the rest of the week. You too figure it out. Get two free 4G LTE smartphones from top brands like Samsung and LG after instant rebate when you switch. Metro PCS. Wireless. Figure it out.
Coverage not available in some areas. Sales tax not included. See store or metropcs.com for details and terms and conditions.